Once again, hello, thank you very much for being here. I'm Sifu Sylvain, and welcome to part 7 of study on the Diamond Sutra, or the Prajnaparamita, or the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. As a little forward on this last few chapters as we close this book out, I want to remind you that this is a very important sutra in Mahayana teaching. So is the Lankavatara, or the Vimalakirti. We're leading to the mother of all Mahayana teaching as the ultimate teaching of Buddha, or the understanding of his teaching, the meaning of his teaching, in the Lotus Sutra. But as we go through the Diamond Sutra, I want to bring your attention back to the idea that this is a conversation being had between Shakyamuni Buddha and a Hinayana practicant who's achieved the highest possible enlightenment available to him in the Hinayana path, which is Arhat. Whether you're picking up on this or not, this has been a transition of that Arhat. At one point, you'll remember he broke into tears as he finally started to let go of a lot of his attachments that Hinayana had drilled into him. Basically, he had become a nihilist. Just didn't have the will or saw the need to go any further than the idea of emptiness or nothingness. And a lot of people who start studying Buddhism, unfortunately, even studying Mahayana Buddhism, get the idea that the end goal is nothingness, emptiness, that what he's teaching is really anti-life. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I think this is the biggest reason that Mahayana scholarship rose and developed around 100 BC to 100 AD. In that period, there were a lot of great scholars that went back to the Pali teachings, the translations of Buddhist or Shakyamuni's sermons, and their capacity was much greater as they were 600-700 years removed from the Buddha's lifetime. And it was very clear to them that the sermons were being narrowly interpreted and misunderstood. And so they went back through all of them and reanalyzed everything that the Buddha was sermoning, and saw very clearly that the nihilist position was one that failed to comprehend the full meaning of his words. And that's basically Mahayana, okay? So what's happening, the reason I pointed out is in this book, it's very obvious that the latter half, and especially the last quarter of this teaching, really takes on the Hinayana point of view, really destroys it, really shows how it has completely failed to understand the mission of practicing Buddhism. That it is extremely life-affirming. That life is the eternal thing. But the force, the energy, the life energy is something, well, we call Buddha. And from that energy, which is potential, comes all other things. And this is the glimmer we get in this condition as human beings in samsara. We have the opportunity to reinvestigate and discover it beyond all our elusive karmic disguises and veils. If we look deeply enough and concentrate deeply enough, the insight we will gain, which is Mahayana's whole focus here, is stop looking at the words. And Buddha said this himself very clearly many times, that it wasn't perceived correctly. That it isn't that we're all simply illusions and the truth lies in our extinction, but that this is an opportunity in this form, in this condition, to clearly see that we are that life energy, that there is no difference, and this is what makes us eternal, but not as beings, not as selves, not as souls or entities. All of that is illusion. What is running through us, around us, doesn't create us. We are from and return to. This is just a temporary phase of perception that we're going through, or experience, as Alan, so Mahayana is much more positive because it shows Hinayanas that what they're missing is that they're not interrelating this study and this discovery of the makeup of the life force with other beings. If they just became focused on their bodhisattva nature and bodhisattva practice, they wouldn't just cave in on their own selves, solitude, and lose any interest in anything extant, which is nihilism. They're just waiting to die. Instead, if they practice bodhisattva practice, they have a reason to go on. They have a reason to watch the blossoming of others. And by doing so, they learn a lot more profoundly what their true nature is themselves. This is the, Buddha said it many times, or Shakyamuni Buddha, the whole Buddhist practice is about suffering and how to remove suffering from life. It's not anti-life, it's anti-suffering, it's anti-delusion. And the way the Hinayanists travel in their practice is a much deeper delusion than the one they think they're trying to escape. So the Mahayanists tend to be pretty strict on the Hinayanists, and they don't necessarily like it. But it is the Buddha's teachings shown in a much deeper, more profound light. And by doing so, it regains its initial investment by Shakyamuni himself. All right. Let's get into it. Chapter 30. Furthermore, Subhuti, if a noble son or daughter took as many worlds as there are specks of dust in the billion world universe, and by an expenditure of limitless energy, ground them into a multitude of atoms. Subhuti, what do you think? Would there be a great multitude of atoms? Subhuti replies, looks getting funky. So there would, Bhagavan, so there would, Sugata. There would be a great multitude of atoms. And why? If a great multitude of atoms existed, Bhagavan, the Tathagata would not have spoken of a multitude of atoms. And why, Bhagavan, this multitude of atoms of which the Tathagata speaks is said by the Tathagata to be no multitude. Thus it is called a multitude of atoms. Also, Bhagavan, this billion-world universe of which the Tathagata speaks is said by the Tathagata to be no universe. Thus is it called a billion-world universe. And how so, Bhagavan? If a universe existed, attachment to an entity would exist. But whenever the Tathagata speaks of attachment to an entity, the Tathagata speaks of it as no attachment. Thus it is called attachment to an entity. The Buddha said, Subhuti, attached to an entity is inexplainable and inexpressible, for it is neither a dharma nor a no dharma. Foolish people, though, are attached. Now, this is again, this is that play of language on two realities. So it's very plain in that one, that all of it is impermanent. And as impermanent, the implication is that it's just a temporary experience. By that understanding, a temporary experience is not something real. It's not something, it's just something experienced. And the experience is constructed by the mind. So what Shakyamuni is saying isn't that nothing exists. Far from that, the mind exists, and everything is of the mind. That doesn't mean that everything doesn't exist and there is nothing. What there is experience of something, but that experience of something isn't empirically real. It's just an experience. And what's having the experience? The mind. And what is the mind? It is Buddha. It is the lens, if you will, of the energy of life, the continuum of the life process. But the process, just like potential, isn't a thing. It isn't a phenomena. It's a condition. So there's no negation of life here. There's just an explanation of the intricacies of what it is that we're experiencing. And in that experience, we have suffering. And so Buddhism's whole goal is to eliminate that suffering component of the process of life. Make sense? Let's go on. Furthermore, Subhuti, if a noble son or daughter took as many worlds as there are specks of dust in a billion, blah, 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 would there be a great mother? The Buddha has finally brought us to his own body, the body of the Tathagata, which neither comes nor goes, and which is our own true body. But having negated any attempt to define such a body in dynamic terms, he turns to static definitions. He knows people will try to view such a body in terms of its unity of form or in terms of its multiplicity of elements. Hence, he provides this example using the largest and smallest entity known to his audience, the atom and the universe. Asanga says, reducing a world to atoms reveals the truth by example. Atoms ground so fine show how sufferings end. Vasubandhu comments, reduction into atoms is meant as an example to show that the true realm of reality, Dharmadhatu, is neither a unity nor a multiplicity, and that it is in this realm that the Tathagata dwells. Energy. Li Wenhui says, atoms of dust are delusions. And the universe is another name for our body. Atoms of dust are the cause. The universe is the effect. But our own true nature has no cause or effect. Once we realize this, there are no atoms of dust. So how could the universe exist? Thus, what is not an atom of dust is called an atom of dust. And what is not a universe is called a universe. Recognize the form? This is energy exists to form the atoms. Energy is the home of Buddha. That's my little side note. Subuddha replied, so there would, Bhagavan, so there would, Sugata, there would be a great multitude of atoms, so on and so forth. That is why it's called the multitude of atoms. This is a repetition of the opening Gatha, if you will, of this sutra, or stanza, as I like to call it. According to one ancient Indian conception, matter is characterized by four elements, earth, water, fire, and wind. Familiar with that, right? Which are present, represent its four states of existence as solid, liquid, heat, and motion. What's heat, by the way? Energy. Every level of matter, whether examined with a telescope, a microscope, the human eye, or the mind, is composed of varying amounts of these four, whether it is a universe of billion worlds or a single Paramanu atom. Here, however, the Buddha is not interested in perception of the matter per se, but any ontological conception, regardless of its size. Because all such entities are either composed of other entities or themselves composed of other entities, they have no nature of their own and do not exist independently of their relationships with other things. Hence, they are not themselves real. And because they are not real, the Buddha speaks of them in order to liberate us from our attachment to them. Okay, this is also another thing that Hinayana misses. See if I can say this correctly. The only term that doesn't seem to be in here translated anywhere is energy itself. He's dealing with all phenomena, matter, and he's saying that that's just a provisional state of energy. But the Hinayana stop at the idea that there's nothing, and they just stick there. They don't go any further. They don't see the implication of the life force, the Buddha energy. That's a homogenic energy, quiescent energy potential, yeah, and that's what I've been saying. So I picked up on my note. all right. Ever since chapter 4, the Buddha has been trying to put to rest the omnipresent belief at the core of our delusions. This belief is an entity in something separate in time or space or mind. All of these entities are entities that our self could not manage to incorporate, and the existence of which it has reluctantly had to admit. And yet, none of them is real. But if none of them is real, then neither is the self real. For if there is nothing outside, there can be nothing inside. Seng Chao says, using many to make one, no entity can be found. Huineng says, to understand the mind, nothing surpasses the two dharmas of compassion and wisdom. It is by means of these two dharmas that we realize enlightenment. As for belief, see, if all you're doing is working on yourself, Hinayana, then you don't understand the practice of compassion. You never develop it, and that's why it's nihilistic. With compassion, you can't be nihilistic, because compassion is always about hope. It's about change for other. It's about all of us change together. It's about the benefit of all of us understanding. That requires compassion. Compassion that knowing that everyone is a Buddha, that let's all be on the same page. That's compassion, you see? That's why he says nothing surpasses compassion and wisdom. The wisdom that derives from compassion is far beyond the wisdom that relies solely on one's own perception. All right. As for belief in an entity, because the mind attains something, it does not believe in an entity. When the mind attains nothing, this is called belief in an entity. Belief in an entity means talking about reality without getting rid of provisional names. The Buddha said, Subhuti, attachment to an entity is inexplainable and inexpressible, for it is neither a dharma or no dharma. Foolish people, though, are attached. In chapter 7, Subhuti says, the dharma realized and taught by the Tathagata is incomprehensible and inexpressible. It is neither a dharma nor no dharma. So, why does the Buddha describe delusion here in much the same terms Subhuti applies to truth? Because truth and delusion are not separate. Delusion is truth seen through the eyes of a foolish being, while truth is delusional seen through the eyes of... Let me reread that. Delusion is truth seen through the eyes of a foolish being, of foolish beings, while truth is delusion seen through the eyes of Buddhas. Such delusions, however, are inexplicable and inexpressible because they are not real. Thus, they are no dharmas. But because people are attached to them, neither are they no dharmas. See, we're really on the razor's edge of the two dialogues here, the two languages. Asanga says, because they only cling to words, Who do you think he's talking about? Fools believe in falsehoods, but since neither self nor dharmas exist, denying them brings no realization. It's the same kind of attachment, right? The denial of something only enforces the something. Asanga says, because they only cling to words, fools believe in falsehood. I just read that, blah, blah, blah. Sing Chao says, what has a provisional name and no individuality cannot be explained with certainty. Hui Neng says, by means of the two dharmas of compassion and wisdom, does one attain the Buddha fruit of enlightenment, which cannot be fully explained or fathomed. Foolish people, meanwhile, grasp at words and actions and don't practice the two dharmas of compassion and wisdom. But if they seek unexcelled enlightenment without practicing these two dharmas, how can they possibly attain it? What is it talking about, compassion and wisdom? The Bodhisattva path. Chi Fo says, the Buddha is concerned that Subhuti is not yet free of attachments and doesn't understand the truth of prajna, and doesn't understand the meaning of the Dharma body and apparition body. For the apparition body doesn't leave the Dharma body, just as atoms of dust don't leave the world. The world is like the Dharma body, and atoms of dust are like the apparition body. Just as the world is broken into atoms of dust, the Dharma body is divided into apparition bodies. The pile of atoms is a world. The apparition bodies are not different. The apparition bodies are also the substance of the Dharma body. The Dharma body is not one, but the Dharma body can give birth to the activity of apparition bodies. The atoms of dust are not the world, and yet the atoms of dust are the substance of the world. The world is not atoms of dust, and yet the world is formed by atoms of dust. If the world were real, it could not be broken into atoms of dust. Likewise, if the Dharma body were real, it could not give birth to apparition bodies. This is work in the mind. The Buddha exists in the mind. Buddha is a clarified way of seeing. So all of that language was really to define that if you're bouncing back and forth between belief and not belief, what you're bouncing through is what you're missing, is the mind. The mind is everything. Now we arrive at Mahayana core of seeing well beyond the limitation of self and no self. Chapter 31. And how so, Subhuti, if someone should claim that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a self, or that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a being, a view of a life, or a view of a soul, Subhuti, would such a claim be true? Subhuti says, no indeed, Bhagavan, no indeed, Sugata. Such a claim would not be true. And why not, Bhagavan? Because the Tathagata speaks of a view of a self. The Tathagata speaks of it as no view. Thus it is called a view of a self. The Buddha said, indeed, Subhuti, so it is. Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path know, see, and believe all dharmas, but know, see, and believe them without being attached to the perception of a dharma. And why not? The perception of a dharma, Subhuti, the perception of a dharma is said by the Tathagatas to be no perception. Thus it is called the perception of dharmas. Again, this usage of language to try to define what it can't. Instead of dharma for a moment, let's think of replacing that word with rules. There is a way of behavior that many philosophies talk to us about as knowing right from wrong. You don't need a book to tell you what's right and wrong in most instances, right? So this is what he's saying. You are Buddha. You are life force, life energy. But you keep looking at, and you're attached to the idea that your life energy is something called a self, or a flesh, or organs, or dust particles. And then you say, well, reality isn't those things. True statement. But now you've gone from affirmation to negation, and you haven't grasped yet that both of those are just conveniences of your confusion, because you're not perceiving the largesse of the mind, the Buddha, the force, the energy, that all of that is contained within those two positions. So if you could just remove those two positions, stop being attached to either or, self and other, duality, then you're left with, see, you don't have to find it. It's there. It's the container you're in. It's life force. It's Buddha. Does that make sense? So he's really nailing Subhuti here. Nothing is real. Sorry, my little dog's doing some weird things. From the Buddha's begging bowl universe, we come back to the belief that represents or that prevents a true perception of a ball of rice or anything else. The belief in the existence of a self from which our beliefs in being, a life, and a soul are derived, as well as our belief in dharmas. The Buddha tells us that to understand the true nature of any entity, whether that entity is a self, a dharma, a Buddha, we must not be blinded by our own perceptions of it. It is not the myriad atoms of dust or the billion world universe that prevents us from attaining enlightenment, but our mistaken views of such things as separate from or permanent, as somehow real. But on closer examination, these entities turn out to be rather arbitrary views of reality founded on nothing more than linguistic conventions, which are themselves the detritus of previously established arbitrary views. And all of these views can be traced back to our own view of the self. Thus, the Buddha returns to the view that began this sutra, set forth on our daily round with an empty bowl, and bestowing this teaching on those we meet. Vasubandhu says, thus, it is not the negation of atoms or dharmas that results in enlightenment, but the negation of our belief in them. This is getting clear, right? Chao Ming titles this, not giving birth to concepts and views. Huey Ning says, the four views are all false. Thus are they called the four views. Thus follows a chapter on not giving birth to concepts and views. Huang Po says, if you want to become a Buddha, don't learn a single teaching of the Buddhas. Just learn not to seek and not to cling. By not seeking, thoughts are not born. By not clinging, thoughts do not die. What is not born and what does not die is the Buddha. Tai Ching says, if the Dharma body is universal and all things are unreal, they can't be seen. So why does the Buddha speak of belief in these four appearances? And how so, Subhuti, if someone should claim that the Tathagata speaks of a view of the self, or that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a being, a view of a life, or a view of a soul, Subhuti, would such a claim be true? In chapter 4, the Buddha brought up the subject of these four manifestations of self and warned against becoming attached to any sanjna or perception associated with their nimitta or appearance. Here he warns against attachment to views, dristi. The difference is that perceptions are much less pernicious and considerably easier to deal with. Hence, the Buddha deals with them at the beginning of the sutra. Views are perceptions that have become carved into our stone minds. Hence, he has waited until now to approach them. In Sanskrit, the word dristi refers not only to what we perceive, but also to what we falsely perceive, our erroneous interpretations of reality. Asanga says, thus views and no views are useless grabs at nothing. Though they form a subtle screen, true knowledge sees right through. Huineng says the Tathagata speaks this sutra so that all beings will themselves realize the wisdom of prajna and themselves cultivate the fruit of enlightenment. Foolish people don't understand the Buddha's meaning and think the Tathagata is talking about the view of a self or a soul, unaware that the Tathagata is teaching the profound, formless, conditionless paramita of the prajna. When the Tathagata talks about the view of a self or a soul, it isn't the same as the views that foolish people have of a self or a soul. The Tathagata says that all beings have the Buddha nature. This is the view of a true self. And he says that all beings possess wisdom uncontaminated by passion and a nature that is already complete. This is the view of a soul. He says that all beings are themselves already free of affliction. This is the view of a being. And he says that the nature of all beings possess in is neither created nor destroyed. This is the view of a life. Chifo says the Buddha is concerned that Subhuti might wonder if the Buddha Dharma body cannot be seen by means of attributes. Why does the Tathagata often speak about a self or a person, and so on? He thus breaks through the views of attachment to existence or non-appearance and reveals the truth of prajna. This concludes Subhuti's education in the perfection of wisdom, which he learned so well he became the Buddha's representative in teaching the paramita of prajna to the gods and his fellow shravakas in the other sutras that make up the perfection of wisdom scriptures. The teaching itself is quite simple, but we are very complex beings and easily misunderstand simple things. To free us from views that bind us to the wheel of rebirth, the Buddha teaches dharmas which are themselves views, and like all views, are empty at heart. But dharmas are views that counteract the views that rule our lives and that ensure our rebirth for countless more lives, so on and so forth. Tai Ching says, at first we cling to seeing a body and mind comprised of the five skandhas and the appearance of the six sensations, and thus attached to appearance, we practice charity in our search for the merit of Buddhahood, which the Buddha breaks through with no attachment. In the Lankavatara Sutra says, this is Sheng Yi, he says, the views of views is the cause of ignorance. No view of views is nirvana. The view of views is putting one head on top of another, which is the cause of ignorance. Last chapter, 32. Furthermore, Subhuti, if a fearless bodhisattva filled measureless infinite worlds with the seven jewels, and gave them as an offering to the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones, and a noble son or daughter grasped but a single four-line gatha of this teaching of the perfection of wisdom, and memorized, discussed, recited, mastered, and explained it in detail to others, the body of merit produced by that noble son or daughter as a result would be immeasurably infinitely greater, and how should they explain it? By not explaining. Thus is it called explaining. As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning, view all created things like this. All this was spoken by the Buddha to the joy of the elder Subhuti, the monks and nuns, the laymen and laywomen, the bodhisattvas, the devas, humans, asuras, and gandharvas of the world, all of whom were greatly pleased with what the Buddha said. This sutra began with Subhuti thanking the Buddha for an example of his daily life and asking how he and other disciples might attain such liberation. The Buddha then told Subhuti they must cultivate both wisdom and compassion by liberating all beings while remaining unattached to any perception of a being, any perception of a self, or any perception of liberation. In this final chapter, the Buddha sums up this teaching that combines wisdom and compassion Not only is it grasped without grasping, it is explained without explaining. Whoever explains his teaching like this does what a Buddha does. This is why the Buddha gets up in the morning and goes to town. This is why the way to Buddhahood and the way of Buddhahood, the magic seed that bears the magic fruit, the body we have never been without, this is the diamond body. Anything else is just an illusion. Although this concluding section is not part of the teaching, it is nevertheless noteworthy for its inclusion of nuns as well as laymen and laywomen among the audience. Clearly, the Buddha's teaching by this time had progressed beyond the group of ascetics that formed the core of his early disciples. Gandharvas, too, are present, as they are the celestial guardians of the truth. Ananda, or was it Vashpa, recollection of this sermon ends with the Buddha said, near the end of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines, the Buddha turns to his attendant and says, Ananda, I once more entrust and transmit to you this perfection of wisdom so that it will long endure and not disappear. If you should forget all other teachings you have heard me speak, that would be a minor fault. But if you should forget but a single verse of this perfection of wisdom, that would be a serious fault, and it would displease me greatly. For as the Tathagata has said, this perfection of wisdom is the mother, the created, creator, the source of all Buddhas of the past, the present, and the future. Therefore, Ananda, I entrust and transmit to you this perfection of wisdom so that it may long endure and not disappear. So, the Lotus Sutra was referenced many times in this. The special points that I want to remind you of, this is not a sutra about no self. That's just a totally wrong interpretation. That's a nihilistic interpretation. Okay? And I think it's clear just from the passages that I read, all right, that the scholarship on this is a correction. It's a correction of not having understood the full implication and the full meaning of what Shakyamuni Buddha taught for his entire life. Those who adhere to the idea that the early Pali texts, translations of the Buddha's or Shakyamuni's sermons, are it. That they're the only true words of Buddha. Well, they're not the words of Buddha. They're the as best as you can imagine the words of Buddha, because the translators had been chanting and repeating those sermons daily over and over and over again. So it's got to be about 99.9% accurate, right? And then it's translated into Sanskrit, and it's translated into other languages, and then into Chinese. And China, a lot of the documents that they translated have somehow disappeared, and we're left with the Chinese translations for all of them. And then later on, Korea, Japan, so on. But there were some countries, like Burma and many in that part of the Asian continent, that only ever received the Pali. And even so, in the Pali, as you will see demonstrated in Mahayana over and over again, there was a limited ability amongst those who studied the Pali canon as to what the foundational meaning, the raison d'être, why was Shakyamuni having all these sermons, what was his goal? And they stopped learning. They stopped pushing their perception. You know, I'll just say it this simply. the Shakyamuni's goal to become enlightenment in the first place, to gain the Buddha wisdom, was to look at life, all life, and see that not only was this opportunity and this condition of human being, could we experience wonderful, fantastic bliss, if you will, joy, and at just the awesome nature of what we can see in our minds, all the while being so attached to that excitement, missing that it came from someplace. And the place it came from is the place we're still in. But we're so busy looking at all the toys and foibles around us that's what creates our suffering. We have insatiable craving, insatiable desire, the same energy of desire that ended up manifesting as in this condition of manifestation. Our human existence is all from the same energy that is the Buddha or life energy without beginning or end. We're like a footprint. And if we understand that our life is like a footprint, ultimately, we understand that that footprint is of the mind. So that the footprint was never there, isn't there, will never be there. It was just a temporary condition, experience that we have of our interminable life force, of which is not ours, but everyone's and everything's. There's no separation. That doesn't mean that there's nothing. What that means is that everything is a matter of that energy, that mind, that knowledge, that prajna, wisdom. So it's not nihilist. And the way that we know it's not nihilist is because he exhorts everyone to save all beings. This is what he constantly refers to. How that was missed is a matter of capacity. It just was too soon for those people of that era, the 500 years after Buddha's passing, to get it. Remember, Shakyamuni spread things out over 500 year periods. He knew this would happen. He knew people were limited and they'd end up falling into delusion and not totally getting it. That it was in the next 500 years that people would start to go, wait a minute, you don't understand. And they go over the same material and they go, see, this is a different conclusion. You didn't go there. You didn't get past your capacity. And in the next 500 years, more elucidation happens. More Mahayana texts go in and say, this is how it works. This is what you needed to understand. It's the same thing I'm doing now. I'm using my words, my era, my way of thinking, and I'm reading these words along with other scholars, and I'm saying, oh, I get it now in terms of my existence. I have much more capacity, so do you, than somebody 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago. They didn't have cell phones in 500 BC or AD. Our capacity is much greater now. So we can look at the same information and say, I get what that's saying. And at some point we get so many ahas, we've got to write a book, right? So this is Mahayana Buddhism. I hope this inspires your bodhisattva practice. And at very least, I feel good now that I've said enough, read enough, and communicated to you enough in my own way. Enough information for you to chew on and get ready, because it's going to take me a little while. I'm going to start a whole series. Now, I don't know how many videos it's going to take, because this is the one on the Lotus Sutra. I'm going to go into it from how it was created, the history of it, you know, every part. And we may just go chapter to chapter. And that's 28 videos right there. But don't despair, because all we're going to do is say the same thing over and over again with a little tweak and a little shift, hoping that every one of those tweaks and shifts at some point, even if you're going, man, what about, I don't even know how to ask this question. And then you'll go to the next video and I'll read something, I'll say something, and I'll find some scholarship about it, and you'll go, oh, I get that. I get that. Well, the moment that happens, I don't want you to stop studying, but I want you to write it down. I want to put it on the wall so that you reread it every day. Make it your launching point, your starting key, your well-charged battery. And let it guide you toward telling others and meditation, chanting. And the more we go through it, the more you'll have more ahas. And pretty soon you'll be telling people about it just like I am. Or better. Better. Thanks once again. Signing off on the Diamond Sutra study. There's still plenty more study to do on it. But I think I've given you the gist of how this plays into the whole Buddhist teachings. Remember, Sakyamuni told us to study it all. He knew some things would hit you and something would miss you. But if you just study enough, your own perception, your own truth about it will become evident. And that's what you need to worship or dedicate yourself to, what you understand. Because it'll only expand if you continue to study. Don't chant to Buddha. Don't chant to me. Don't chant to anything other than your own understanding. And use the Gohonzon as a mirror to bounce that back at you, to show you how it looks when it's fully enlightened. Let it take you into that trance mode by distracting your human mind and cutting through the chaff to give you a totally free space of Buddha life force to see everything in its naked truth. Okay? Namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo. I so appreciate you. Thank you, my fellow Buddhas. Bye now.